Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hi, everybody. You're listening to All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. T-minus 48-ish hours and counting. Thanksgiving 2018 is upon us. 155 years ago, President Abraham Lincoln proclaimed Thanksgiving a national holiday. Still to this day, certain traditions continue, and most of them have to do with food. Pumpkin pie, yes, please. Stuffing, of course. Sweet potatoes, you know it. We all have our favorite Thanksgiving dish, and today we want to hear about yours. But to help us guide this conversation is Carla Lally Music, food director at Bon Appetit. Hi, Carla.
Hi.
Now, if you'd like to chime in, or maybe you need a last-minute recipe to bring to Friendsgiving, or maybe you just want a straight answer to some basic questions, or you want to go wild, brine or dry rub, roast or fry, give us a call, 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-WNYC. These are always fun segments to prep, Carla.
It's a fun week.
So, speaking of prepping, should I start now? Should, as soon as I get off the air, if I've got people coming on Thursday, and what can I do this far in advance?
I think if you haven't done anything, the first thing you want to do is get your shopping list in order. So I did that myself this morning, 7 a.m. I was sort of figuring out what. And I'm not hosting, I'm bringing, but sort of planning out the dishes, looking at the recipes, making sure that I have everything in the house when I get up tomorrow, because that's, I think, when the prep, you want to really get going, do as much as you can on Wednesday, so Thursday you could maybe like take a shower before people come over.
So is there an order that is probably the best order?
So there's definitely an order to things. I think figuring out and knowing what you can do the furthest in advance and tackling those things, really getting them out of the way. So things like making your turkey stock. I picked up my turkeys last night. They cut them up the way I wanted them. I've got the bones. So I'll start my stock tonight. Pie dough, you can do 2, 3, 4 days in advance. Well, we're within three, so let's just say two. You can definitely make your pie doughs and get those into the discs and get them in the fridge. This year, we spent a lot of time thinking about make ahead. Mashed potatoes, you can make 2 days ahead all the way through from start to finish. And that is like a great thing. I usually do that Thursday morning and bring it over to my mom's this year. I might do the whole thing tomorrow and put our content to test. And things like toasting nuts, drying out the bread for your stuffing, getting the brine or the dry rub onto your turkeys, Tuesday, Wednesday, totally great times to do that.
Perfect. So you said let's talk about desserts. You can get pie dough in the mix already, pardon the pun. Sweet potato or pumpkin pie, do you have a preference?
We're a pumpkin pie family. I don't know if I've ever had a sweet potato pie.
You need to come over to some black people's houses.
Oh, okay, that's what I need to do.
That is a very southern black people thing.
We do a sweet potato dish that one of my aunts brings over, and she puts chipotle chili in. So it's like a puree, but it's like got the smoky spicy, and then it gets baked.
Oh, that sounds amazing.
Yeah, but we do pumpkin pie, which my younger son, when he couldn't pronounce his consonants, called in pie. So we still call it in.
I love family traditions like that. That's such a great one. It's interesting. You have this great video because maybe you don't want to make a pie. Maybe you want to go a little crazy. You have this video about making a perfect rustic apple tart.
Yeah.
And the approach to the crust was really interesting because usually when you make a crust, they tell you to get to the butter to little pea size, little round marble size.
Yeah.
But in this case, you use the butter in chunks. And explain why and what happens.
So I really love this method for pie dough where instead of squeezing or using pastry cutters or two knives, which I think a lot of people, it's you're not connected to it as much. You use a rolling pin and you can roll the butter into the flour. And so instead of getting little bitsy pieces, you get these long sheets. And what happens when the sheets are incorporated in the dough, when they bake, the butter melts, it releases steam, the steam pushes the flour mixture open, and you get these really nice flaky, like when you bite into a croissant, you see those nice flaky layers. So that is one, and doing it by hand without a food processor so that you can really see what's happening every step of the way. I feel like beginners might not know, but I think when you put something in a food processor, you're one step removed and you can overprocess the dough. That's when you get a tough dough.
Oh, sure.
That's not flaky or crumbly, but just sort of like tight and crunchy.
It's really neat in the video, and I hope people can Google it, or maybe I'll tweet it out, because you get to see the ribbons. And that's just, it's very, it's visual. You know, it's really, you get the sense of like, oh, this is how I get these air pockets in
exactly.
my tart.
Yeah, it's a naked apple tart, I think we call it on bonappetit.com. Mm-hmm. And if you go there, you'll get a link to the video.
Okay, we've got a caller. Anne in Park Slope. Hi, Anne. What's going on?
Hey, how's it going? Happy holidays to you both.
Thanks so much.
I'm calling because you're asking about recipes. Last year, I made my very first turkey.
Cool.
And I made it in front of a party of like 12 people. And I wanted to do something foolproof. And I followed Alton Brown's turkey brine recipe.
Sure.
Which is, if you actually, for people who are like looking to do a turkey right now, this is the time to do it. You can start defrosting the turkey because it needs an overnight brine.
And this is a wet brine. It's a wet brine, if I'm correct.
It's a wet brine. We actually ended up using like a 5-gallon Home Depot bucket with a plastic liner inside nice. It to brine it overnight in the fridge.
I like it your actually, commitment, Anne. I like
oh,
the commitment.
I felt a lot of pressure. I was like cooking for 12 people. But, you know, we brined it overnight, and then it looks like it should never work because you then dry it, and it has to go into a 500-degree oven for half an hour.
Right.
And then it's like at 350 degrees for only 2.5 to 3 hours. Everyone was going, is this possibly going to work? And kind of the only downside was you can't really put stuffing in the bird.
Right.
But when it came out, it was so juicy. And even more important, I think, for like Thanksgiving partygoers, it makes for the juiciest leftovers ever.
Yeah.
There you go. Anne from Park Slope, hope you have a good holiday. Thank you so much.
Thank you, you too.
If you want to join the conversation, our number again is 212-433-9692, 212-433-WNYC. If you'd like to share a recipe or if you have a question, we've got an expert here, Carla Lolly Music from Bon Appetit. She's the food director. Anne brought up a whole bunch of questions.
Mm-hmm.
So first of all, brine. My sister is the person who makes the turkey in our family. She has been on my case to make sure the turkey we get is brine, 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 brine. She's very specific. What is the deal with brine?
So the first thing when people say brine, I need to ask wet brine or dry brine, because there are two different types. So the type that the caller just described is definitely a wet brine, which is a salt and sugar solution that often has, you know, some other spices in there. You submerge the entire turkey in there. Then there's like all this fabulous osmosis is happening and the salt's going in and the juice is coming out. And it really does help to make a really juicy bird. The reason why I don't advocate for brining is to also to her point, 5-gallon bucket lined with a plastic liner, New York City. You know, if you have a deck or a backyard or an extra fridge, like sure. But for me, having the space to do that has always been kind of a tricky proposition.
It's challenging, yes.
So I'm a big proponent of the dry brine, which is sometimes also just called a dry rub, which is
that the pastrami rub you're talking
about? Yeah, there's
about?
One of those, a pastrami style turkey breast on bonappetit.com. But really what it is a combination. The key thing is the combination of kosher salt and a certain amount of sugar. Then you can add dry spices to that. You can go in a barbecue direction. You can go in a pastrami direction. You can go, the one that I make every year has aniseed and fennel and orange zest in it, which is really nice. But instead of submerging, you're rubbing that mixture all over the outside of the turkey, inside of the cavity. And then again, the time, 12 hours minimum, 2 days is great. I'm going to brine mine tonight, cook it on Thursday. And it does a very similar thing. So it really helps season all the way to the bone, which everybody loves to complain about turkey being bland. This takes care of that. And it also does, the salt and the sugar is having a similar kind of reaction, and it does make things very juicy. she mentioned starting at a very high temperature with the wet brine. And that's one of the downfalls, I think, of a wet brine, is that you also want to get brown, crispy skin. So having submerged it in liquid can sometimes be fighting against you. I think that's why the Alton Brown recipe starts at 500 to really dry out the skin so you can get crisping, and then you're lowering the temperature. Key with the dry brine, you need to rinse or wipe that all off. And again, same thing with the stuffing. You're making your stuffing on the side. Some people prefer that, though, because you get, you know, more crispy corners.
Exactly. And people fight over that.
That's true.
You know, the brine has hit a nerve.
Yeah.
We've got Julie in Manhattan. Hi, Julie.
Hi. That was quick. here's my question. So I'm making Thanksgiving, and we have members of our family coming who are kosher. So we have ordered a kosher turkey, a fresh turkey, not frozen. But we find that kosher meat is kind of salty.
Yep.
So my question is there any way to kind of debrine or get some of the salt out of the kosher turkey before I put it in the oven?
I don't think so. I think what you're, because when the bird has already been koshered, the salt is no longer on the surface. I would be careful with things that are around and next to the turkey. So I would definitely do the stuffing not stuffed inside. I would do it in a baking pan outside of the bird. That way, any residual salt that's inside of the meat is not going to also oversalt your stuffing. I would also be careful with the pan drippings and maybe not put those into the gravy. So again, on bonappetit.com, we have a recipe called umami gravy that just came out. That is a process that you can do 100% ahead of time, starting with turkey stock that you flavor and season, and then you make a roux and basically turn that turkey stock into gravy without depending on the drippings in the pan. Mm-hmm. So if you have a pre-salted bird, the drippings are going to be very salty. If you use those pan juices in your gravy, then you can make the gravy too salty. So I would just be careful with some of those things. And then also make sure to have, I really am a big proponent of like a big green, bracing, bright, acidic, crunchy salad, like a kale and apple situation or escarole and pear, and keep that on the bright lemon juice forward. And that acidic kind of dressing will balance out if you have too much salt somewhere else on the plate. It'll just balance out the palate.
Julie, thanks for calling. For you, Carla, are there any non-negotiables when you're making your turkey? Like, this has to happen or this can't possibly happen. Non-negotiables.
Non-negotiables for me, brining has become a non-negotiable.
Controversial.
Getting online early enough to snag a wing is non-negotiable. I love the turkey wing. I think, you know, even if you're just roasting a turkey breast, keeping the bone in and the skin on during the roasting is really important. And then I've never cooked a frozen turkey. So I think having a fresh turkey that I go to the Meat Hook, which is a great butcher in Greenpoint. And I know they know where the birds came from, mm-hmm. the farm that they came from. They're fresh. They've never been frozen. You're getting them the day you pick them up. They're, you know, fresh turkey, I think, is important.
All right. We're going to go to Mickey in the East Village because Mickey's been making turkey for a long time now. Hi, Mickey.
Yes, I watched my mother make turkeys from the 50s on. And by the 60s, I was in college, and I was the one who made Thanksgiving dinner for all the students who couldn't get home for Thanksgiving. So I've made Thanksgiving dinners for a long time. And the things I think are most important with the turkey, I mean, it depends on the turkey, and you can get all this turkey stuff and brining all this new stuff, and I would be willing to do it, but over the decades, the most important thing is, first of all, basting. If you don't baste, I think you're going to lose it. And you have to baste from the beginning, mm-hmm. which means I start with quite a bit of butter melting in, and then it mixes with all the juices. But I think you have to have something to baste from the very beginning and not after the turkey starts dripping. It really helps. And then the second thing is some sort of cloth on top of the turkey to absorb, to keep the moisture on the turkey. And, of course, you take it off at the last 2 minutes so it's browner, you know, as it should be. And I've used everything, but the most common thing I've used is a clean T-shirt.
Oh, wow. That's cool.
Mickey, thanks for calling.
Okay. Bye-bye.
That's a big issue. People want to keep their turkey moist.
Yeah.
Other things they can do besides T-shirts?
So my mom actually does something very similar. She covers hers with cheesecloth. There's a lot of butter. We've always been big on basting, having butter around. But really a lot of the key to not drying out the turkey is limiting the amount of time that it spends in the oven. The longer the turkey's in the oven, the more exposure to dry, hot heat. The more chance you have of drying out. So if you're having a lot of people, rather than scaling up to like a 20-pound bird, which has to be in the oven for hours and hours, do two smaller ones. So we advocate for like a 12 to 14 that's going to serve 8 to 10 people. So if you have 16 people coming, get a bone-in breast to go with that rather than roasting a giant bird, which is when they dry out, is when they've been in the oven too long.
My mom used to wrap bacon.
Oh, yeah, sure. Bacon helps everything.
Bacon does help everything. We've got a recipe from Takita. Hi, Takita.
Hi. Can you hear me?
I can. What recipe do you want to share?
Awesome. So I have a family traditional recipe that has been brought down from my great-great-grandmother for ambrosia.
Oh.
We have been doing ambrosia for a very long time. It is a dish that you can have as dessert or a nice soft palate with the heavy Thanksgiving meal. And so usually the night before, I get two canisters of sour cream. I get two full bags of small marshmallows,
mm-hmm.
big bowl. I put everything in. I mix it. Then I have diced pineapples, mandarin oranges, and dark cherries,
ooh.
All of which I drain, pat dry, and mix those in. Keep mixing. And the last piece I do is a little bit of shredded coconut.
Ooh.
And what you do is after you mix it all up, you let it sit in the fridge overnight. And when you scoop it out on the side of your dish after you've gotten your greens or your mac and cheese or your squash and turkey, you have a little dollop on the side. And as you're getting full, having that soft marshmallowy sour cream feel lightens up your entire palate for the Thanksgiving meal.
You have two buyers here. Takita, thanks for sharing the recipe. That actually sounds
like a
great recipe that you could bring if you're a guest, because guests always want to bring something. What do you suggest? What are good dishes for guests to bring?
That's so smart, because when you're bringing something, finding dishes that actually are better when they are made ahead. So like the ambrosia needs to sit overnight to be excellent. I think, as I mentioned before, I'm a big proponent of having the salad. So you can show up to someone's house with the serving bowl, all of the washed greens, everything ready to go, your vinaigrette on the side, maybe some toasted nuts. That's a great thing to show up with. Wouldn't it be amazing if you showed up at somebody's house with gravy? I mean, that's like one of those last minute things that gets so frantic with the drippings and the pan and the thing and the scraping and the degreasing. You can make the gravy ahead. You can season it really perfectly. You can show up with 2-quart containers of gravy and like kind of save the day. And then dessert is also another area. I mean, bring a bottle of wine.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing, if you're not a great cook but you want to contribute, bring like a big thing of mayonnaise and some great sandwich bread.
For the next day.
For sandwiches the next day, which then your host doesn't feel like they have to put that out in that moment or that you're crashing in on somebody else's menu. I mean, a great thing to bring is whatever the host asks for. So, being really upfront and saying, I'll bring anything that you need rather than trying to figure out what you want to bring to kind of show off. And then when it comes to dessert, I think some nice chocolates, a box of caramels, some cookies, something that isn't going to take center stage away from the pie, but can be passed with dessert. And everybody, will appreciate.
It's also noshable. It's you can just kind of have a cookie.
Exactly.
Terry has a question, and Terry is calling us from Brooklyn. Hi, Terry.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well.
My question is, so I live in a kosher Jewish household, and we have a meat oven, so we can't cook dairy in there. And so then, obviously, the Thanksgiving meal would be a meat meal, so we wouldn't have dairy. And I figured out how to kind of do substitutions for almost every dish, except the one I'm having trouble with is pies, because I personally don't really like using shortening as a substitute for butter. And so I was just wondering if you had any ideas about what could be used instead to still make it kind of delicious and flaky.
Yeah, I think if you're if you don't want to use shortening, which I totally get, another fat that is similar in that it is solid at room temperature and has a very similar construction is coconut oil. And you can really use coconut oil almost one for one in recipes that call for butter. I would pull back a little bit. So if it's 8 tablespoons of butter, I would substitute with maybe 7 tablespoons of coconut oil. It doesn't have the water content that butter does, but it will behave in a very similar way. And if you just want to sort of make sure that things, not everything ends up tasting super coconutty, look for a refined coconut oil, which isn't a bad thing. It just means that it is gone through a second stage in the processing where a lot of that coconut forward flavor is going to be toned down. So not everything tastes like, you know, sunscreen.
We're talking to Carla Lally Music. She's the food director at Bon Appetit. She's responsible for the food across all their platforms. I want to go to Holly, who's calling from Morristown, because Holly is an ambitious woman. There are 20 people coming.
Wow.
And Holly, what's your question?
My question is, I'm okay on all the food, but when it comes to pies, I'm trying to actually make my own pies and have them really be good. So I've frozen my make-ahead apple pie, but I want to do a pumpkin pie and wondered, could I make the crust but not bake it on Wednesday and make the pumpkin pie filling but not put it in until Thursday? Just assemble it, you know, bake off the crust, assemble it, and then finish it off without making my kitchen a mess. Would that work?
100%. And I would even say that in addition to making your pie dough, you can line that pie pan and do the blind bake ahead of time. So that's another kind of time in the oven that you can get out of the way. So doing the blind baking where you're just getting it dried out light golden brown before adding that custard base filling. Once it's blind baked, just wrap it really well in plastic wrap and then you have your filling. Bring them together. I think that's a really smart strategy.
I think stuffing has not gotten enough attention in this conversation, and that is where I park myself.
Yeah.
You can keep your bird. I'm just at the stuffing. Patty from Spring Lake has a question about stuffing. Hi, Patty.
Oh, hi. How are you?
Good. What's your question?
I'm just wondering, you know, I make two different types of stuffing every year. One's a vegetarian, one's the sausage with the dried cherries. And you didn't mention, like, can I make those today, like 2 days beforehand, or do you not recommend that? I usually make them all on, like, Wednesday night at, like, 12 o'clock at night.
Right. Yeah, I've been there. So I think I think that is a very smart thing to do. Most stuffing recipes are going to have sort of two stages. There's the stage where you're combining the bread, the seasoning, the stock, the eggs, whatever is going into it. And then usually you cover your pan with foil, you bake that until it's dried out. And then the second stage is when the foil comes off and you do the last 15 or 20 minutes to get that top surface nice and crunchy and craggy. So you can do that initial baking where it's covered in foil if that's how the recipe is written. Just make sure that you cool the mixture down 100% before it goes into the fridge and then bring it out and let it come to room temp or, you know, let it sit for an hour and a half before you put it back in the oven to finish browning. And it might take a few minutes longer than it would had it been warm, you know, before you took the foil off. But yes, 100%. I think you can assemble, pre-bake, and then finish the stuffing the day of.
All right, we've talked bird, we've talked greens, we've talked sides, we've talked gravy, we've talked dessert. Last question, we now have to talk cocktails.
Yeah.
Is this a time for mulled wine? Is it a time for sparkling wine? What do we do?
I love the idea of a sparkling wine. I love a spritz. So if you want to have sparkling wine, get yourself some Prosecco, maybe a bottle of Campari or Aperol. Do Aperol spritz beforehand.
Pretty orange.
Which is really nice. a little bit lower alcohol than doing, you know, like a whiskey-based cocktail. We have a cocktail in this issue that is very similar, but it instead of having sparkling wine, we use dry cider, sparkling hard cider, but a dry, not a sweet. And mixing into that Averna, which is a type of Amaro that should be easy to get at any wine store. So you get this sort of like the dark fall flavors, the Amaro with the cider and some ice and a orange zest. That is really, really nice. I think mulled wine is great. It's maybe a little heavy. But yes, totally down with that. And I also like Lambrusco. You can get a nice dry Lambrusco. A lot of people think that Lambruscos are going to be like grape soda. There's some really great dry ones out there that also have that sort of festive, you know, very purple, grapey fall color. If you, you know, you have a wine shop that you trust, ask them if they've got a nice dry cider, dry Lambrusco, some Prosecco, and do some spritzes.
Carl Lally Music, food director at Bon Appetit. Thank you so much. You gave us 30 minutes of great information. And you have a cookbook coming out in March. Will you come back?
That is correct. I would love to be here.
All right. Carla, thank you so much.
Thank you.
We'll be right back with another installment of Andy in the Archives with WNYC's chief archivist, Andy Lancet. This is All of It on WNYC. You're listening to All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart, and now it's time for our regular trip through the station's archives with WNYC's chief archivist, Andy Lancet. Today, Andy's going to walk us through some of the station's most famous broadcasts, hosted by the People's Mayor, Fiorello LaGuardia. Hi, Andy.
Hi.
So I think those of you know about Mayor LaGuardia and WNYC know that he came into radio, onto the radio, to read the comics to kids during the newsman strike.
Well, actually, it was the newspaper deliveryman strike for 17 days in July of 1945. Now, the papers were actually printed. It's just they weren't getting distributed. So the mayor, feeling for the city's kids, read the comics on three occasions during the strike, and he even ordered WNYC to have a daily reading of the funnies called the Comic Parade. So here's the mayor reading from Dick Tracy.
And if you remember, she starts stripping and tearing up the laundry. And she has all of the money in bills in a pillow slip. And we hear wet wash. Listen, baby, I know you're a maid at Van Hoosen's. I saw you there last week. And I know there's something phony about that dough. Now, when we get it, it's going to be 50-50. Okay? Then maybe you'd like some more of your laundry torn to pieces. Rip! She's ripping that laundry there, and that little delicate piece of lingerie. And he looks in. Ye gods, I lose my job over this. Stop, you win. I'll settle for $5,000.
Okay, so the mayor had a regular show in WNYC, Talk to the People. What was Talk to the People?
Well, right after the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor in 1941, LaGuardia took a page out of FDR's fireside chat playbook, and he started a regular Sunday broadcast at his desk from City Hall, and even sometimes from Gracie Mansion. And it was his way of sitting down with New Yorkers, his constituents, and covering all of their major concerns.
Paris and Romania. Two great events. Taking of Paris, of course, brought joy to the hearts of people all over the world. For when Paris is happy, Europe is happy.
What were some of the issues that LaGuardia tackled on Talk to the People?
Well, it was wartime, of course, so New Yorkers were faced with price controls and rationing, and black markets, blackouts and dimouts, air raid shelters and drills, and as there are today, issues involving Albany and the governor. And he would read constituent letters like this one dealing with racial discrimination in the city.
It so happened that a young colored boy of approximately 8 years of age asked for a glass of milk at a drugstore soda fountain. The boy was told by the attendant that no milk was available to him. He left the store and took his trouble to the officer on the beat, who returned with him to the store, suggesting politely that all children, regardless of color, should be served. The attendant refused to give the boy milk in spite of the officer's urging. Then followed a firm lecture on the importance of practicing democratic principles. This resulted in the boy receiving his milk, the attendant acknowledging his dangerous point of view, and the witnesses glowing with pride at a policeman's performance. I hope that this is but a single manifestation of many more to come in the post-war era. And thanks for writing in. I don't know this officer. You've given me his number. I hope he's admitted to the bar. If he is, I'll make a magistrate out of him. That's the kind of common sense we need on the bench.
Now, LaGuardia was quite a character, what the kids would call extra today. Did any of his eccentricities come through in the program?
Oh, for sure. And he didn't hold back, especially when it came to Nazis, loan sharks, and those he frequently called tinhorns and gamblers. But he loved New York's kids. And here he's interviewing a girl from the city's PAL program.
What's your name and how old are you?
My name is Paula Spalter, and I'm 18 years old.
And where do you live, Paula?
I live at 1087 Carroll Street, Brooklyn.
And what PAL center do you go to?
I go to Wynn Center. And between you and me, Mr. Mayor, it's the best one of all.
I bet they'll all say that. Tell me, how long have you been a member of PAL?
About 1 year.
And what do you do around the center? I mean, what's your particular interest?
I'm a member of a dramatic club and a choral singing group. I also go in for folk dancing, and I like to play ping pong and volleyball.
Well, that ought to keep you pretty busy, and in good physical condition, too.
It sure does, Mr. Mayor. When I join that singing group, they may complain that I didn't sing sweetly enough, but they can complain I don't sing plenty loud.
That's good. You'll be a councilwoman someday.
I love Mr. Mayor. Now, Andy, in the Thanksgiving spirit, you've brought us some special tape of LaGuardia instructing us on how to make a turkey, a big turkey in a little oven?
Right. This is from late October 1945, and his honor was keen on New Yorkers overcoming an annual challenge.
Now, we're going to meet city conditions, you know, the small gas range and the small oven, and this is how to make use of a larger 20-pound turkey in your smaller oven. The dealer will draw the turkey. The legs are removed above the knee joint. After the skin is raised so that it can be replaced for stuffing, the neck is removed deep down in the carcass. The stern of the turkey, you know, that's the rear end of the turkey, they call it the rudder here, it's cut off about 1 inch. The legs are then pushed forward and tied down with a string right around the body, holding the legs bent up towards the breast. The wing tips are removed at the first joint and held with small screws or toothpicks. Now, this will form a very nice compact bird that you can put in your small oven. But don't take the pieces that have been cut off and roast it with your bird. Don't do that because it'll just shrivel up and dry. Keep those and you can make turkey soup with it. You can make sauces with it. You can make several dishes.
That is a full service mayor, Andy.
Full service, indeed.
Thanks to the New York City Municipal Archives and WNYC's chief archivist, Andy Lancet. Thank you so much, as always.
Thank you.
And happy Thanksgiving
to
you. If you want to hear more of Mayor LaGuardia's Talk to the People program, you'll find it in the listing at wnyc.org/archives/collections. I'm Allison Stewart. This is All of It on WNYC. You know, yesterday I asked Tim Wu, Columbia Law professor, who's written a book about monopolies, especially in tech. I asked him if he thought maybe Facebook was approaching a tipping point in terms of consumer satisfaction. He said, very possibly. There's the monopoly issue. There are all the lies being spread on the platform. Then there's Facebook's dodgy behavior when confronted with these issues. A recent New York Times story might put more scrutiny on the internet giant, both from the consumer and Congress. Joining us now to talk about the latest news in the world of Facebook is friend of the show, Issy Lipowski, senior writer at Wired, who has done a considerable amount of enterprise reporting about Facebook herself. Issy, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So that story, that New York Times story, let's talk about that one first, and then we'll dive in a little bit more on some of the work that you've done. It really focused quite a bit on COO Sheryl Sandberg in a way that we really haven't seen. And you had actually six questions that you had after reading that, six well-informed questions. And you want to know about her future. So what's changed about the perception of Sandberg from, let's say, a year ago? Where was she a year ago, her standing, and where is she now?
Right. I think the perception of Sheryl Sandberg is she has always been sort of the cleanup committee. She's been the adult in the room. That's the reason why she was brought into Facebook. Mark Zuckerberg was a CEO at a very young age of this massive company, and Sheryl had a lot of executive experience.
Yeah, there's a 15-year age difference between them, I think it is.
Yeah, I'm not sure exactly, but something like that. And so she has always been, you know, treated in a more favorable light. She's an exceptional speaker. She comes out, speaks to Congress and really speaks with authority, a little bit more authority than Mark Zuckerberg did when he came out in April and was a little bit stuttery and robotic. But there hasn't been a lot of criticism of her in the past. Whenever Facebook has had these blow-ups, Mark Zuckerberg has gotten a lot of the flack. This story really was one of the first to paint her in an unfavorable light, to paint her as sort of the puppet master behind the scenes, going to Congress, trying to meddle with legislation being introduced, trying to steer the direction of these congressional hearings that have been happening. She, since the reporting has come out that she has taken the blame for hiring this public affairs firm called Defiance Public Affairs, that the New York Times article says, you know, was pushing a lot of opposition research about Facebook's opponents and its critics. And that is something that obviously is not the sort of perception that Facebook has been trying to put out there as this vehicle for social good, as it often says. And so I think that kind of laid the situation bare.
All right. We'll talk about the definers in a minute. Now, the Wall Street Journal actually was reporting that, you know, Zuckerberg and Sandberg, there might be a little bit of tension there. That was always sort of, they were in lockstep with Zuckerberg and Sandberg, and that there might be some tension between the two. What are your thoughts on the fraying relationship?
Yeah, this is the first we've really heard about that. The Wall Street Journal's reporting that Mark Zuckerberg basically blamed Sheryl Sandberg for the fallout of the Cambridge Analytica scandal, which you'll remember was the situation where a political firm had misappropriated the data of tens of millions of Facebook users without their knowledge. And the fallout from that has been considerable for Facebook. Obviously, Mark Zuckerberg's been drawn to Congress, and there's, you know, a huge outcry for data privacy regulation in the United States, similar to the ones we've seen in Europe. And I think Mark Zuckerberg sees Facebook as taking all the brunt of this, even though this is arguably an industry-wide problem. And because Facebook is the chief operating officer, because she's sort of considered to be the policy person within Facebook with these relationships that she has with Washington, the fact that it's all gone so poorly, I guess it's not surprising that he would lay that at her feet.
And there's also the issue that the Times pointed out that Sandberg was not as much for transparency about all the issues with Facebook as some other people in the company wanted her to be.
Right. That's really the core of the New York Times story, which is that the chief cybersecurity officer at Facebook, Alex Stamos, began investigating Russian meddling on Facebook shortly after the election. And first off, Sheryl Sandberg apparently wasn't thrilled about that. She said, you should have had approval from the company before you went rogue and did that. There were later squabbles about whether Facebook should specifically name Russia in a white paper they were putting out about foreign election interference. Facebook decided not to name Russia in that, and the New York Times makes it out to sound like that was largely to do with Sheryl Sandberg's opposition, and also another leader at Facebook named Joel Kaplan, who does a lot of the policy stuff at Facebook. And then, you know, there was another blow up mentioned in the New York Times story where Alex Stamos essentially discloses to a selection of Facebook's board members that, you know, we have found all these fake personalities. They're backed by this Russian internet research agency, and we don't know if that's all that there is. We don't know if we found the extent of the problem. And that was the big fight that's detailed in the New York Times article, and that Alex Stamos has since, in a Washington Post op-ed, acknowledged that, yes, this did happen. But critically, Alex Stamos says, no, nobody ever told me not to investigate this stuff. But obviously, there were issues around how transparent Facebook was going to be with the public and with its board about what it had found.
Outside of the details in this piece, does the overall theme of this piece and the way Facebook allegedly operates, does that surprise you based on what you've reported?
It doesn't, because this is, you know, one of the most influential, dominant, and valuable companies in the world. Why should we expect that it's going to operate any differently than so many other, you know, juggernauts in business, whether it's big oil or big tobacco? And a lot of people have thought of this year as sort of Facebook's big tobacco moment. You know, they've had this series of scandals that they've had to defend, and we're coming to find out that behind the scenes, even as they're projecting, we want to do better, we want to be more transparent, behind the scenes, they are working to protect their own reputation at all costs. And I don't think that's surprising if you look at Facebook as just another corporate giant.
It's interesting that American people will forgive a mistake, or they'll forgive a wrongdoing as long as you come clean about it. It's the hypocrisy and the cover-up. And that seems to be, especially with a platform like this where people are putting pictures of their children, there's sort of like this personal element to it that I think a lot of users are. I have friends who just really, people I never thought would say this, say they're going off Facebook, they've had it.
Right, well, I think that obviously, Facebook is getting a lot of blame for having allowed this election meddling to happen. But yeah, I think you're right that there is sort of this dual narrative that they not only allowed it to happen, but then they tried to hide it. And I think people don't like when their executives, and especially the ones that they feel, you know, were leading their businesses in different ways, which Facebook has always promised to do, are actually acting the same as, you know, same old in the business world.
We're talking to Issy Lipowski, senior writer at Wired Magazine, about Facebook's future. Okay, you mentioned earlier the Definers, this group, the Definers. If you're polite, they deal in opposition research. If you're a little more caustic, they deal in smear campaigns. How were they engaged by Facebook?
So they were hired by Facebook basically to investigate Facebook's critics, including this one group called Freedom from Facebook. And Freedom from Facebook is backed by some progressive groups like the Open Markets Institute that have been traditionally Facebook critics. But what Definers began doing was pushing to reporters, including myself, what they'd found about the financial ties behind Freedom from Facebook, including its ties to George Soros. Now, on one hand, you could look at that as this is a campaign finance story, and why should George Soros be treated any differently than, you know, ties to the Koch brothers? But on the other, we know that George Soros has become this boogeyman of the alt-right, and that lately especially it's grown to sort of a dangerous extent. He was one of the recipients of these mail bombs recently. So I think the second you start introducing a smear campaign that's targeted in some way toward George Soros, you're into really sticky territory. And so as soon as the New York Times story came out, Facebook severed ties with Definers. Definers has since, you know, come out and defended itself, saying, no, we were not engaged in explicitly anti-Semitic smear campaigns. We were merely trying to show that this group that looked like a grassroots group was actually financed by George Soros and some other, you know, well-heeled investors. But obviously, it doesn't look great for Facebook to be involved in these sort of dirty tactics that are synonymous with Washington.
And part of this was pitching journalists stories and trying to feed them stories. And I understand you folks at Wired were on that receiving end. How did that happen?
Absolutely. Well, I mean, I can't get into too many of the details, but they would, you know, say, hey, how about you look into this op-ed that was just written, and what are the ties behind that person? How are they connected to Open Markets Institute? Maybe look at this person. Who are they? Are they doing double duty, working simultaneously for one organization, but also having one foot in Open Markets Institute? So there was a lot of that sort of suggestion, that sort of tip building.
Does it come via email or via voicemail?
Both.
Both. Oh, that's really interesting. You know, is the story in the Times connected at all to your reporting that this is a really interesting story you wrote, that the top political advertiser on Facebook is Facebook?
The top political advertiser on Facebook is Facebook. I think that all of this has to do with that fact, because Facebook has been, you know, having to be its own biggest advocate, and it owns, you know, the biggest ad network online. So why not, you know, push that message to its own followers? So Facebook has far outspent, you know, top spenders like Beto O'Rourke and the Trump campaign on ads that say, you know, Facebook is battling fake news, Facebook is doing better, Facebook is improving. I will say a large part of that ad spend also had to do with get out the vote efforts and voter registration efforts. But it is interesting that Facebook has tried to push this message that Facebook is better on Facebook.
Classic. We're talking to Issy Lipowski, senior writer at Wired Magazine, about Facebook and its future. So why is it on Facebook's the news feed that sort of the craziest, the most extreme stories always pop up to the top?
Well, I think that's partly to do with Facebook's algorithm, and it's partly to do with human nature. I mean, and Mark Zuckerberg said this the other day, we see it in cable news, we see it in tabloids, you know, the most extreme, if it bleeds, it leads. And there's a reason for that. It's because people click on it. The problem is when you apply that to a scenario like Facebook, its algorithms are designed to reward what you click on. So the more you click, the more you'll see those things you click on. And so it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. Facebook has recently made a change, or it announced it's going to be making a change, where it's going to try to limit the spread of this sensational content. So this is content that they're saying doesn't necessarily violate their policies. So in other words, it might not explicitly be hate speech, but say it's offensive speech, or it's not explicit nudity, but it comes kind of close to the line. They say that this content tends to still get tremendous engagement. And in the past, because it doesn't violate their policies, they leave it up. but they feel like that's not contributing to a healthy conversation on Facebook. So they're going to start tweaking their algorithms so that that content, which they're calling borderline content, and it remains to be seen what that will really include, but so that it won't have so much of a reach.
We're talking with Issy Lipowski, senior writer at Wired Magazine. We'll continue this conversation about Facebook. And specifically, I want to talk to you about Senator Mark Warner, the senator who seems to get all this. We'll take a quick break and we'll see you on the other side. And we're back. This is Allison Stewart. This is All of It. We're back with Issy Kapowski. She's a senior writer at Wired, and she's catching us up on all the latest things to do with Facebook. And I wanted to ask you, I was talking to Kara Swisher a couple weeks ago, and she said that the one congressman or a congressman who really understands how serious these issues are and maybe even has some solutions is Senator Mark Warner of Virginia. He's vice chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee. And you've done a Q&A with him. He was mentioned in this Times article. And you did some reporting with him and you got to interview him. Can you explain to us why he seems to be someone who understands big tech and all of the nuances of the issue?
Well, first of all, he comes from the industry. He comes from the world of telecom. So he comes from a place of understanding, which we've seen in a lot of these hearings. A lot of the senators don't.
Yes.
But I think he's also just done his homework and his staff has done their homework. He's taken his role as vice chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee really seriously since the 2016 election. And obviously, you can't disentangle the 2016 election from Russia's disinformation campaign, which took place largely online. So if you're going to investigate that, you need to have this understanding. So he, along with Senator Amy Klobuchar, introduced the Honest Ads Act. That is a piece of regulation that was designed to apply sort of the same disclaimer standards that apply to broadcast political ads, to apply them online. Right now, you can run political ads on Facebook, Google, wherever, and highly target them, spread them to millions of people, and they're really unregulated. So he introduced legislation that's trying to change that. It hasn't really gone anywhere, but it's sort of a stake in the ground to show where maybe we could go. And I would just say, in terms of the data privacy issues that have come up, he's also been really active on that issue. So I think that he's been sort of this guiding light and a really important voice on the Intelligence Committee that a lot of other senators are trying to pick his brain.
You wrote a recent story about Facebook and how about a concealed carry group that brought millions of ads on Facebook. How did you find out about this?
So this was, interestingly enough, talking about digital online mm-hmm. ads, because it's an unregulated space, Facebook and other companies have created their own ad archives. So this is a response basically saying, no, guys, we're good. We can self-regulate. They've created this space where you can see who the top advertisers are on their platform, and you can see all of their ads. So I'm skimming through, and as we talked about, Facebook is the top political advertiser mm-hmm. on Facebook, but otherwise it's people like Beto O'Rourke, Donald Trump, billionaires like Tom Steyer, J.B. Pritzker, and then in the top 10 list, I see this company called Concealed Online. So I check out their ads. Their ads are using a lot of scare tactics saying, you know, Democrats are going to win the House. Mob rule is coming. The blue wave is coming.
Wow.
Apply now to get your concealed carry permit. And essentially, this is a business that sells these online certifications that you can use to get a concealed carry permit in Virginia. And these Virginia permits, you can get them even if you're a non-resident, and then you can use them in a number of other states. So I was really interested in who this company was. You know, they've spent more than $10 million on political ads. That's almost as much as ExxonMobil. And you go to their website, and, you know, it's pretty simple. It's a business model. They're selling these certifications for $65. There's absolutely no information about who is behind this company on their website. You know, their address is a virtual office. Their phone number is some call center. So I went digging to see who's behind it. I ended up finding the guy who...
It's a guy?
It's a guy.
The guy.
He says he's, you know, he's not in this for the politics. He says, I'm an internet marketer. I saw this as a business opportunity, and I'm allowed to run these ads. There's nothing stopping me. It's not regulated by the FEC. It's, you know, firmly within Facebook's rules, and so why not? I'm using this language because it works, and it's not necessarily even my personal politics, but if it's going to help drive sales, that's what I'm trying to achieve. So I thought this was really interesting because it brings to light two different issues. One is what we've already talked about, which is that this divisive rhetoric sells on Facebook, and so you have a lot of businesses capitalizing on that just for pure commercial purposes, not even for partisan purposes. And then this other regulatory issue, which is that online you know, digital political ads are this complete no man's land, and anything goes. So you can say almost whatever you want, and as long as you know. As long as it's not caught by a reporter,
right?
you'll get away with it.
Before I let you go, there are two issues. One is in Myanmar and one is in Iran. Tell us about Iran's trolls, the Facebook trolls.
Sure. So obviously we're familiar with Russia's Internet Research Agency trolls. What we found in recent months is that Facebook has found similar networks of fake accounts originating in Iran. Some were originating with Iran's a news network in Iran and posing as international news outlets, and then also setting up, you know, fake accounts that look like people who were pushing these news stories. And so it looks like, even though Iran has been engaged in these tactics for a long time, they've evolved, and their more recent campaigns that have been pulled down look a lot like these Russian accounts. They capitalize on really divisive content, and Facebook has taken them down because they say this is coordinated inauthentic activity, and that's banned by their rules.
We don't have time to talk about the Myanmar issue, but I suggest that you go Google Issy Lepowski at Wired Magazine and read some of her work. She's done some great enterprise reporting about Facebook, and thank you for walking us through that enormous New York Times story as well.
Thank you.
Hope you come back. You're listening to All of It. I'm Allison Stewart, and we'll be right back after the news.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.